This edition of Meet the Writers was first broadcast on the 2nd of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. My guest today has had an extraordinary life.
I could talk very eruditely about post-colonial, post-structuralism and post-modernism if I wanted to, but as a writer, really, I'm just struggling with the impossibility of conveying the richness of reality on the page.
That's Nigerian poet and author Ben Okri today on Meet the Writers. Booker Prize-winning novelist and poet Ben Okri has launched his new novel, The Age of Magic. It's a beautiful work full of poetic and metaphysical revelations. The book takes the reader on a journey, a magical and a literal one, as a tightly knit group of filmmakers travel from Paris to a remote Swiss mountain village. Once there, they're compelled to confront the demons that they've all been trying to escape. Well, Okri is considered one of the foremost African writers of the postmodern period. At 21, he published his first novel, Flowers and Shadows, and in 1991, The Famished Road, which won the Man Booker. He's won many other awards, including the Commonwealth Writers Prize. He's published 8 previous novels, as well as collections of poetry, short stories and essays, and his work's been translated into 26 languages. Ben Okri's also the recipient of many honorary degrees. He's Vice President of International Pen, and he was presented with the Crystal Award by the World Economic Forum for his outstanding contribution to the arts and cross-cultural understanding. He's a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature, and he's been awarded an OBE. He was born in Nigeria, and most importantly, he's here in the studio with me now. Ben, thank you so much for coming in.
It's a real pleasure to be here, Georgina.
Ben, I'm wondering about the whole trauma of moving countries, of moving, you were very small when you moved from Nigeria to Britain, but moving back from Britain to Nigeria, you were at a very impressionable age, and that must have been quite a wrench.
The wrench wasn't so much the moving back, it was the perception of moving back, because I remember at school, many of my classmates at the time had all these ideas that Africa was a really rough and dangerous place where people lived in trees, and animals like lions wandered the streets, and they told this to me when it was announced to me that we're going back, and I expressed my reservations to my mother at the age of tender age of about 6 or 7. That, you know, these were the reasons why I couldn't be going back. And Mum was as horrified as you can imagine she would be. She said, "Ben, do I look like I've ever lived in trees?" And I said, "No, but, you know, my mates wouldn't lie to me." It just goes to tell you the power of wrong perception. Anyway, I eventually did make the journey under a profound piece of trickery by my mother and got to Nigeria and found it the most astonishing and revelatory place. It was a journey back that completely changed my life. It was like going from a beautiful, brilliant black and white movie into an exploding Technicolor.
And of course, the Civil War was there when you were.
Yes, the Civil War caught me unpleasantly and the whole nation, but it was very much entangled in my childhood. It became very much a family trauma as well, because it divided my family, because my father came from one side and my mother the other. So a lot of the Civil War was spent trying to stay alive and trying to hide my mother. It was also a very formative period for me, because it was a time in which I saw for the first time dead bodies and people being killed and just the whole nightmare that a Civil War is to a child.
And of course it's informed your writing enormously.
It has done, and as it should do, because it brought me face to face with death at a very, very early age and compelled me to ask all the important questions that has since haunted my work. You know, questions like life and death. It's what is the meaning of life, and what does death, why, the inevitability of death, and evil and goodness, truth and appearance, courage and cowardice. All of the things that war brings out in people, the great things as well as the really deeply evil and troubling things.
And these are themes that you explore in much of your work. You then made the reverse journey back to Britain. Why?
I came back to Britain ostensibly to write. It seemed at the time that I came to study, but the real reason I came was to write. I'd begun writing. I'd begun my first novel in Lagos and finished it. I'd also begun writing short stories and poems. But it was a very difficult environment at that time to write. I I now know that it is a different environment now. It's much richer. There are many more possibilities. But way back then, it was much, much, much tougher. And the perception of writers wasn't a very favorable one. Most parents felt that the more solid professions were ones like engineering and law. And writing was considered a very rebellious and somewhat non-existent form of a career.
Were your parents disappointed that that was the path you'd chosen?
Well, my mother's always been deeply supportive of me and kind of realized quite early that I had what seemed to be a gift. My father wanted me to be a lawyer. He was a lawyer. I dreamt that I'd inherit the law profession from him. And he spent a lot of my childhood, as it were, grooming me for the law. He got me to read his books, took me to court, argued with me often on philosophical and legal matters. And as it turned out, while he was grooming me for the law, in fact, he was grooming me for a life in words and literature and imagination. Just goes to show you that, you know, our intentions often have unexpected results.
And you published your first novel at just 21. That's very young.
It was published early, and it was the publication of that novel that actually got my father to sort of change his mind about me, because he was in court one day defending a rather arduous case when the magistrate, was it the judge, called him over and asked him in a kind of whisper, "Do you have a brother by the name of Ben Okri by any chance?" And my father said, "Why?" And I said, "Oh, I've just read his novel, Flowers and Shadows. It's a very good novel." And my father drew back proudly and said, "No, he's my son." And I think after that, I got off the hook.
It wasn't all easy, though. I mean, you had tough times. Homelessness is something that you've written about.
I think, the life of a young writer is bound to be a difficult one, and should be a difficult one, because those are the years that actually make the deepest impressions on you and inform many of the great questions. And I had the slight misfortune and the considerable fortune of actually being quite broke, and for a time was homeless, and found myself having to sleep in parks, park benches. I know what the bitter ash-like quality of dawn is in a winter's morning, seen from a park bench. Those are special feelings that inform my sense of compassion for my fellow human being, because I got to see life from that raw and difficult side. I say it's been fortunate because it enabled me to have a kind of a roundedness to my sense of the human condition. Because on the one hand, on my mother's side, I come from a kind of royal family, and then there was a war, and then there was a homelessness. So it was fortunate for me that I actually got to be able to experience these difficult aspects.
Ben, I want to talk about being a writer of prose and a writer of poetry. Do you have to put yourself in a different headspace to write different things? And how do you choose which stories you tell in which medium?
That's a very, very important question, and a difficult one to answer, actually, because I think inspiration, the inspiration for an idea, comes to you complete with its form, sometimes complete with its tone and even its length. The trouble, of course, is whether one listens to what that inspiration, what that idea is saying. It is very rare that you have an idea or an inspiration for a poem that then becomes a short story. It's happened maybe only once or twice. But the twinge, the throb, the inner landscape of an idea, it already carries within it the full body of what it can be. And one's job really is just to be ready and to be disciplined. Often with short stories, you actually have a short story that you want to write before it has become an idea that throbs in you. Then it becomes an act of craft, an act of deliberateness. And with stories like that, I have to replant them in my mind for a long time and wait for them to refertilize in me as a desire. It's very rare that I can have a desire to write a short story and then set about writing it immediately. It has to come from within me. The same thing with poetry. I have a poem that I've been wanting to write now for the last 2 weeks. It was something that happened to me, and I felt this would make a wonderful poem. But the poem could arrive tomorrow, or it could arrive in 7 years' time. There are some things one cannot really, really hurry. Mm. But a novel, once begun, can't be hurried or can't be willed, but it can be encouraged, it can be seduced, as it were, partly by an act of discipline and by an act of great desire and love.
Talking about the actual physical process of writing, you're ambidextrous, or you go between hands?
I used to, but I don't anymore because I kind of was born, I was kind of left-handed and had to be trained out of it. And sometimes when I'm very, very tired from using my right, I do use my left, but I've now trained myself back into my right. I save my left for surprises.
You mix the real and the spiritual worlds. You draw on myths and beliefs of your African heritage. And of course, that means that you're often compared with Salman Rushdie or Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And I know that you've rejected the tag of magical realism. Why is that?
Because I think it's inaccurate in its description of what it is I'm trying to do. I think that critics are, you know, well-meaning, highly intelligent people, but they do fall into the laziness of grouping things that appear to be similar together. And sometimes it is a matter of just understanding the depth of one's intention. My work appears to have the clothing, the external features of magical realism, but if you look deeply into what I'm doing, it's a different kind of realism. I'm unwilling to give it a name itself. It does have magical elements because I believe life is fundamentally magical, but it's just the way I go about it that's different. And I'll give an example. You take something like The Famished Road. It is about a spirit child, and a spirit child is half human, half dream, half human, half spirit, as it were. And if I was going to be true to his tone, writing in a first person, he would be somebody who, in this room, for example, would see not only the tables and the cup and the magazine and the computers here, he will also see the drifting dreams. He'll also see the spirit presences. So if I were to write about that, I would write about both equally. It is the realism of consciousness that I deal with. And consciousness for me is, I think, maybe the central determining factor in every people's worldview. For me, it's a consciousness thing, because the way we see the world is the way we're partly conditioned to see the world, the way we're partly trained to see the world.
You've been connected with postmodern and post-colonial discourses. What do those mean to you? And did you set out to produce that kind of work, or was it an area that you were surprised to find yourself in?
I could talk very eruditely about post-colonial, post-structuralism and post-modernism if I wanted to, but as a writer, really, I'm just struggling with the impossibility of conveying the richness of reality on the page. I don't think in terms of any isms. If there's anything that I think determines, that characterizes my writing, I would say it's about three things. One would be a constant struggle to find ways of getting narration to express the multivalence, the multidimensionality of reality as I perceive it and as most people perceive it on this planet. That really does require a turning in, an extending, a stretching of your craft, because reality is the most elusive thing. The second is that I kind of a born innovator, or at least I'm born interested in innovation, partly because I wanted to be a scientist when I was a kid. And so I'm constantly asking questions about the possibility of form and of language. I'm constantly trying to push the boundaries of my chosen métier, of whether it's the short story, whether it's the poem, whether it's the novel, to push it, because language and reality, there's a kind of a gap between them. And there's a sense in which our reality is only understandable to us to the degree that we can get language to wrap around it. So to push the form fascinates me. I think it's one of the greatest tasks embedded in the responsibility of being a writer and an artist.
I wanted to take us into Africa's relationship with modernity, which has made, I guess, spirituality and traditional culture hard to sustain in some ways, but perhaps it also empowers traditional cultures in the way that traditional languages like Igbo and so on are being used across social media now.
One of the power of social media is to open up the possibility of languages across the globe. And I think the question of language is one of the really profound ones, not only in Africa, but across the world. We live in a time when many languages are under constant stress for their survival. And this social media is invaluable in that respect, in keeping languages alive. Now, in terms of modernity itself, I've always contended that the African spirit is almost intrinsically modern. There's something very elastic about the African spirit. We have this ability to embrace the new, and to anticipate the new, and to leap with and leap even beyond the new. And I think it's because the African spirit also is in love with innovation. We like new things. We like new possibilities. And it's because If you were to trace the source of that, I would say it is the imaginative matrix, which is at the heart of its storytelling. The shift from compassion for Africa to invest in Africa is one that should have taken place 20, 30 years ago. I don't know why it took the world so long to see the extraordinary possibilities of that continent. And I would like to suggest that, you know, the possibilities of that continent is not even, we've not even scratched the surface of it. Mm. I think Africa is poised right now to surprise the world in all sorts of astonishing ways.
How much of Nigeria's present day problems, and I'm thinking about the Boko Haram, for instance, the rise of militant Islam, is involved in your work now?
I mean, not the rise of Boko Haram, because this is more of a recent phenomena, but its causes are deeply embedded in my work, because things that appear now don't have their causes now. They have their causes go way back into the history of a place and a people. And in terms of Nigeria, those causes go as far back as, you know, many of the troubles brought about during independence. They're implicated in the Civil War. There are many, many problems that have not been properly and seriously addressed: corruption, equitable distribution, poverty, the misuse of the astonishing oil resources that could have transformed that nation into being one of the great nations of the world. These things are kind of sideline issues to the Boko Haram thing. But more directly, the way in which it has not been satisfactorily dealt with has been a cause of great concern to many of us in the world. And we still feel that it is a problem that can be resolved much more swiftly if there was a more concentrated will to solving this problem.
Ben, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking about your new book.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse, and eminently digestible world of food, drink, and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs, and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
I'm in the studio with Ben Okri, who's the Booker Prize-winning novelist and poet, and he has a new book out. It's called The Age of Magic. Ben, it's a beautiful, beautiful book. Before we talk about its content in detail, you've changed your publisher.
Yes, I've now moved to Head of Zeus, which is Anthony Cheetham's publishing firm. The thing is, I've had a long relationship with Anthony Cheetham. He published 5 of my earlier books, and he's now set up this publishing house, which has a great remit. It's a beautiful, beautiful house. They publish books in the most powerful and aesthetically pleasing way. It's a small house, and it has, therefore, the qualities that I like in a publishing house, which is freedom, lightness of movement, and the kind of flexibility. You know, they can run with an inspiration. They're fleet-footed. They can get their books about. They don't have to go through long, complicated executive decisions. And I happen to think that Anthony Cheetham is a kind of a genius of publishing. It's a real honor to be back with him.
And what he's also done is re-release 4 of your previous works. How difficult was it to choose those 4?
It wasn't difficult at all. They were just the 4 that he had published in an earlier incarnation, which I had deliberately kept out of print because I wanted them to be together in the right house, and Anthony has now brought them out in a most beautiful format. Mm. If I were to run through them, it's In Arcadia, Dangerous Love, a kind of a love story set in Nigeria just after the Civil War. Mm. A Way of Being Free, a book of my linked essays, which is a big favorite with people around the world. And to my mind, one of my secret favourite of my works, Astonishing the Gods.
Which has been called a modern-day classic. In Arcadia, is that really a forerunner to this book, to The Age of Magic?
It is a sort of a forerunner. I see them as interlinked, independent but interlinked works. And if I'm lucky, but you know, you can never count on how inspiration strikes. If I'm lucky, I hope to have a kind of a trilogy, just exploring in as many different ways and as deeply as possible the relationship between Arcadia and our times, between the quest for happiness and the crisis in which we find ourselves in the world.
One of the lines in the book, a wonderful line, is that books should be lived to be read.
Yes, I've always believed that. I think that we read too lightly. I think we read too quickly and we read a bit too lightly. I think we read with the surface of our brains. I think our eyes rather intelligently and lightly skim over the surface of words and we turn the page. I think to enjoy a piece of reading, one ought to suffer it a little. One ought to enter into it like a world. With the books I love, I reread them. I reread paragraphs. I read very slowly because I don't really want to finish them. I want to immerse myself in that world. I want to immerse myself in its secrets and its possibilities and the beauty of its language. And that's how I write. I would love my readers to read slowly, to go into a sentence, to occupy a sentence, to wear the jacket of a sentence, as it were, to swim in it and to move around in it.
One of your characters, Mistletoe, talks about breathing a secret hour alone, which I just thought was so wonderful and something that I, and I'm sure every busy person, yearns for.
Yes, I know. We live lives of such raciness, busyness, and time consumption that we don't leave enough time for ourselves to breathe the secret hour, which is an indirect and poetic way of speaking of the value of ritual or the value even of silence in our lives.
And of course, with every Arcadia comes the flip side, and you have a fantastic description of the devil, but you make him so glamorous. I want to meet him. I want to give him my soul.
I think it is maybe one of the misconceptions of our world that the devil appears and looks absolutely evil and horrible. All you have to do is think about it for a minute. If the devil is standing in for all those sins and evils that we fall into quite easily, then we're talking here about something deeply seductive to our souls, something really deeply seductive and even quite beautiful. It has to be something stronger than temptation itself. So or rather the character conceived of a devil much more commensurate to the ease with which we fall into the pits and troughs of our times.
And you have a completely new word, or at least a word that's new to me, a new verb, eviling.
Yes, eviling. It just really derives from my fascination with language, with the way in which some words appear to contain their opposites. You take a word like live, for example, when you flip it around, it becomes evil. So it gives you an occasion for thought. Every now and again, it makes you think that maybe language itself might have, as it were, developed by instinct, by accumulation, but then also it might also have developed by a kind of secret intelligence. So if evil is the opposite of live, of living, of growing, then, you know, the idea of eviling could be, as it were, seen as a way in which, while one is alive, one is putting away the possibility of one's life, of one's growth, of one's awareness. It came with a character. There are a few other words like that, not just in English, but I found fascinating how languages seem to carry inside them a secret compartment of other ways of reading the world, almost as if language were itself a kind of philosophy sometimes.
The book explores fame and how fame can destroy perhaps people, but an entire town. Is fame something you think that you need to be wary of? Is it something that you feel perhaps has been detrimental in your own life? Because, of course, you are now very, very well known indeed.
The only reason I was pointing at you was because I was just acknowledging the fact that you picked that up. It is one of the secret themes of the book. To answer your question, I think fame is a thing that fascinates our age very much because we're obsessed with celebrity and we're obsessed with the idea of being more largely known than we are at any given point. But I see something fringe in fame, which is quite dangerous to the human spirit. I wanted to explore that in relation to places, because some places have been ruined by fame. They become too famous for their own good, and people have descended on them and destroyed them. Not just now, but throughout time, we've heard of places that have, as it were, been eaten away by the cancer of fame. I am fascinated by the dark side of fame, definitely by its bright side, but also by its dark side. And if you're to ask me what that dark side is, I would say it's the way in which it magnifies the ego. It magnifies the light that shines on the ego to the detriment of the deeper and richer aspects of our humanity.
Ben, finally, I want to ask you, where is, perhaps you haven't found it or perhaps you don't know, but where is your personal Arcadia?
So that's a rather awkward question for you to be asking me at this point, if you don't mind my saying so. Have I found my Arcadia? I'd like to think that I'll go on searching for it. I'd like to think that an Arcadia is something that keeps drawing you towards your own enlightenment, your own self-discovery, that keeps drawing you towards the beautiful possibilities of life. I love the idea of arrival, but I like even more the idea of being drawn continually into constant exploration and asking of questions, which is a simpler way of saying that I'd like to be lucky enough in 5, 6, 7 years' time maybe to complete the Arcadia trilogy. Then you will get the richest answer I could give you.
Well, the first part in that trilogy is out now. It's called The Age of Magic. It's by Ben Ockrey. It's published by Head of Zeus. They've also republished 4 of his previous novels, and all of them out in good bookshops now. Ben Ockrey, thank you very much. And that, I'm afraid, brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Meet the Writers with me, Georgina Godwin. My producer was Claire Urban. Join us again at the same time next week when I'll be talking to Polly Sampson. But for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.